Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it is your turn. Tell us about your story.
I picked a story called The Island of the Immortals by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Yes, and we have featured her before, have we not?
Yes, we did the ones who walk away from Omelas.
Had you read this one before, or how'd you find this one?
No, I just her name popped into my head. I did some searching around for short stories and found this one and liked it enough to say, hey, let's do this one. That day and the next morning, walking about the town, the name of which I could not find written anywhere, I felt that the Yendian tendency to depression had bottomed out here, attained nadir. The islanders were a sad people. They were listless. They were lifeless. My mind turned up that word and stared at it. I realized I'd waste my whole week just getting depressed if I didn't rouse up my courage and ask some questions. I saw my young boatman fishing off the jetty and went to talk to him. "Will you tell me about the immortals?" I asked him after some halting amenities. "Well, most people just walk around and look for them in the woods," he said. "No, not the diamonds," I said, checking the translatomat. "I'm not really very interested in diamonds." "Nobody much is anymore," he said. "There used to be a lot of tourists and diamond hunters. I guess they do something else now. But I read in a book that there are people here who live very, very long lives, who actually don't die." "Yes," he said placidly. "Are there any immortal people in town? Do you know any of them?" He checked his fishing line. "Well, no," he said. "There was a new one way back in my grandpa's time, but it went to the mainland. It was a woman. I guess there's an old one in the village." He nodded toward the island. "Mother saw it once. If you could, would you like to live a long time?" "Sure," he said, with as much enthusiasm as a Yendian is capable of. "You know, but you don't want to be immortal. You wear the fly gauze." He nodded. He saw nothing to discuss in all this. He was fishing with gauze gloves, seeing the world through a mesh veil. That was life.
Well, what'd you think of it?
Oh, I really liked it. It has both that quality of philosophical exploration that The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas had. And also it has like a lot of scene, like what fiction is, you know, like character doing things and talking to people. And it read quickly and it was so clear and smooth and it made its points in a, it wasn't like dense philosophy where you have to kind of like squint and try to figure out what's going on, you know, it said what it said.
Yeah, I think you're right that she has a good balance of reminding you kind of repeatedly that the premise of the story is what has is begging this philosophical question, right? And then it's like the scene is almost like, oh yeah, and I have to do this scene part. I feel like she's one of those like sci-fi writers that really sits there and brainstorms something great, and then the questions just sort of naturally follow. Similar to the Omelas, you do like have a picture in your mind's eye of what these things look like, but it's almost like secondary. It's almost not as important as like what the questions are, you know? But it's weird that you say you like this because this was so gross and depressing.
Oh, I didn't say I liked the like it.
Yeah.
Oh, what a lovely, happy little portrait of immortality.
Yeah, no.
It makes me wish to live forever.
Well, so the part that you read is it's a good section to read because it's got the dialogue, but it feels like it captures the first two thirds of this short story, which, like you said, is very short and reads very quickly, but is very much all about this narrator, this main character, trying desperately to go see these immortal people that nobody seems to have the same enthusiasm about. She's having trouble even like getting the travel agent to book her.
I love that's a great opening for this thing. It's like
Yeah.
the travel agent's doing everything they can
Yeah.
do to talk her out of it. And so much so that she actually books herself this trip because of the travel agent's reaction, which is like, she's like, fine, I'm gonna
Right.
go to this island because you're
Yeah.
being so weird about it.
Yeah, being really cagey about it. And probably if they're being asked this a lot, like being cagey is the only response, because what are you going to say? Actually, you don't want to see these people. It's very depressing. It's going to mess you up forever. Like that's as strong as endorsement as like you really need to see these people. So yeah, she's going to go either way, but like it sets up like there's a lot of tension as to whether or not she's going to get to see them or find them. And there's a little bit of confusion, like you said, about why these people are not being direct and like answering her questions. And then when she finally gets there, it's such a blow. The reality is just nothing that she was preparing herself for, but also nothing that any of these people even directly hinted at. It's weird how they just don't talk about it. It's almost like this collective shame that this community feels. And it's not as if anything is really their fault, but you know, maybe they don't feel that they're taking care of these people properly. And that's what they're all kind of looking away from a little bit. But I was gonna to make another point about like the tone of this exact conversation that you highlighted, because it's, I kind of thought that the existential question that we were going to be asking was more in line with this conversation that you read, where it's like, do you want to live a long time? Yes. Do you want to live forever? Well, no. And this person doesn't make the distinction for her in the specific case of these immortal people, which is that they have zero quality of life. By the time you see these like creatures, they're blind and deaf and they can't move. They can't feed themselves. They're like completely unaware of like life around them. There's zero quality of life. It's not just that they've lived a long time and learned a weird lesson. And if you're not reading this with a sci-fi lens in mind, this is a classic question that we all ask ourselves all the time. Well, I wish we could live forever. You know, why not? And the answers that we come up with are very much like, oh, well, you know, like death gives meaning to life. And if you lived forever, maybe you wouldn't take risks or do any of these other things. And instead it's like, oh, that's right. We're reading a sci-fi novel or a short story. And instead it's like, no, actually living forever means you're like a little larva and they're going to like bury you in the ground and turn you into a diamond. Yes, it's much worse.
It means that you can't die. Even if your arm gets cut off, your eyes are gouged out, something happens to the rest of you, you get buried in the ground and can't eat for 10,000 years. Then what happens to you buried in the ground for 10,000 years? You can't eat. You're still alive, but your body is undergoing something.
Yeah. And those are the questions that we don't think about when we think about, oh, wouldn't it be nice to live forever?
Yeah.
Yeah. You just kind of assume living forever means being young and hot and with all your faculties forever. That's not what that means.
Yeah. The one that she encounters, they're like, it's a feeding time. We feed them at 6 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock at night. Do you want to help? And she's like, I'm going to throw up.
Yeah.
He's like, it can't hear you. Or I think the person
it's
refers
like a she.
To, yeah, she can't hear you. She can't talk to you, but she's happy to accept your prayers.
Yeah. Oh, man. I mean, the strength of this story for me is very much what I just said, which is that I go into stories like this with my own set of questions about what immortality would mean. It's not something that we've never thought of. And then for it to just be flipped on its head so definitively, it's like, oh, absolutely not. No one wants this life. Yeah. And then the power of sci-fi is to just like make it the reality.
To show us.
Yeah. Yeah, not to ask the rhetorical question of, well, what if you couldn't eat? And what if, like you said, you had to keep living? Yeah, it's to show you. And then there's this added layer of the fact that it's a literal like circus freak show. And it makes our narrator just feel gross about herself too. I mean, like you said, she doesn't want to stick around for the feeding because it's gross. But I think by the end, she feels some of that collective guilt.
That's one thing. We said it's a short story, like short as a short story. It reads really fast. It's very easy to follow. And so that's all it is. Like in some certain ways, it doesn't need to be more than that. That's not to say that there isn't more than that in this. Like there's a whole, like when she's talking about how she visited a land that's actually was in Gulliver's Travels.
Oh, right.
Now it's been a really long time since I read Gulliver's Travels and I do not remember Laputa, what that is or what his satire was about, you know, all the places that Gulliver visited satirized aspects of Jonathan Swift's contemporary Britain. So I have no idea in memory what Laputa was satirizing, but it was part of it. It was one of those, it wasn't the little people, the Lilliputians. It was a different one that nobody remembers because it's one of the later travels. But I was just thinking about like that paragraph where it's like, oh, I had visited Laputa and talking about Gulliver and the same one that Gulliver did. It made me think, is she setting this up as like a satire? Like, does immortality refer to something? Because, you know, a lot of times when you write it, when you have a story and you want to signal to the reader to think about things in a way that's not direct, like to signal that what you're about to see isn't, don't take it at face value. Look at it through this other lens.
Right.
As a writer, you can introduce like that other lens in some other part of the story. So it kind of keys up the reader's approach so that they know to think about that as they're going through the rest of it. And so I had that thought reading this, like, is this kind of like a Gulliver thing where we should approach this story in a similar way and think about her as saying something through this to a larger point? I didn't come up with anything. I thought it stands on its own pretty well. And I'm sure you could come up with like immortality can symbolize this. And the fact that it's wretched says this other thing about that thing that it symbolizes. And, you know, if we sat here for a couple minutes, we'd probably come up with like 3 or 4 different examples. It'd be pretty easy. And maybe we should. And maybe that's what she intends us to do. But the story doesn't need to do that to be clear and to make its point. outside of that idea.
Yeah. Maybe it's the fact that it's sci-fi, but and that this is a pretty dark one. But when you introduce any kind of a creature like this, it's really easy to just remember the story for that. You know, like even if there were these underlying meanings that we're supposed to read a little harder for, that's not necessarily what I'll come up with when I recall this piece. I'm going to come up with like the strongest visual.
Yeah.
Of all the stuff I read, even the stuff that I really liked in the moment, if I can recall like the premise of your story, that's good. That means it was memorable enough to stick. You can't ask for all of it. But I think for this piece, whether or not there is, like you said, that underlying meaning she really wants us to strive for, I'll remember the visual, but also the implication of that visual being this question of, do you want to be immortal? And the answer for this story being absolutely no.
That's right.
You know, like that's a takeaway that I'll also remember for this one.
A kind of a, something that goes along with that, but I don't think in any way that Le Guin would have intended, unless she's like some kind of crazy person. But when I first started reading this, the way it opens, it said, somebody asked me if I'd heard that there were immortal people on the Yendian plain. For some reason, and this is probably totally idiosyncratic with me, I was reminded of that Ozymandias poem by Shelley, which starts off something, I met a traveler from a faraway or a foreign land. And the poem is like, I met a traveler and the traveler told me about reading something on a statue. And it's like, it's telling a thing like three stages removed from the reader, from the first person character. That itself is a statement on immortality, right? Because Ozymandias is like, what is left of my kingdom? Just ruin and sand. Like there's nothing around. And yet it ends with like, look on my works, ye mighty in despair, something like that. You're like, there's nothing here. What are your works? So anyway, that connection with immortality. And I don't know why I made that connection in the beginning, but it came to mind because of the way she starts this. And it's a first person narrator talking about hearing things. And then she's doing research and reading about the land of the immortals and getting information that way. Right. And then going and it, like everything is just being told to her. Like she's reading books. She's talking to the boat person, the villager who even introduces her. She doesn't talk to the immortal. She sees the immortal, but the most of the information is told to her by the person. I don't know if there's anything there, but it's an interesting, like I think Shelley doing Ozymandias, there was a reason, like there's meaning behind layering that statement. Like you get Ozymandias. Ozymandias's statement about look on my works is so far removed from the person reporting it to us as the speaker of the poem that it's like it's totally abstract, right? And we get that sense of desolation. His kingdom is not extant. It's not even being witnessed. It's like hearsay, a hearsay of desolation, right? And it's similar in this, is like she has to put it all together. That's not something that Le Guin actually put in there, but it's one of those features of the story that I thought about. It's what you can do with point of view, in other words, is what I'm saying.
Okay, that makes sense. By the time I finished it, I couldn't figure out what a translatomat was. I'm like, is this just a translator? Is this a machine?
Yeah.
They're like little things like that. Is that what you took it to mean?
Oh, yeah. It's just a funny word for Star Trek's universal translator or something. It's translatomat. Okay. It's like laundromat. It's like an automated translator, right?
Yeah. I was like, is this what she's like carrying around?
And the fact that it's a physical thing she can hold out in front of people is like part of it.
And then there's this little like turn of phrase where the woman that takes care of this immortal being that the narrator goes to see is explaining why she herself does not wear the mosquito netting.
Oh, yeah.
There's this one line of dialogue and she's like, it's too much trouble, she said in a quiet, unofficial voice. The children always tear at the gauze. Anyhow, we don't have many flies and there's only one. The narrator says, you mean there's only one immortal at a time? Oh, no, there's others all around. And she doesn't really respond to the question of like, what do you mean by there's only one?
Yeah.
And then the very end of the story is the paragraph where the narrator is reflecting on that. And she says, I'm still not certain what the woman in the village meant when she said there's only one. And then she kind of thinks about it. She's like, maybe she means that of all the flies out there, only one of them can make you immortal by biting you. I guess I didn't know what to make of all of that, because for me, like I said, the big thing I'll remember from this story is what these immortal creatures looked like and the fact that they had no quality of life. And I don't know that I'll really remember the bit about, well, the odds are slim that this will happen to you. You know, I don't know. I didn't know what to make of this being the final note.
It's almost like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, right? Where it's like, there's a random chance and most people aren't going to get it. This is, if you want to find symbolism, like this is more symbolism, right? But narratively, it's also kind of like we talked about before, it's like a ratcheting up. It's like the final kind of like turn of the screw to like just build that impact. I mixed metaphors there. You turn a screw to build an impact, but you get it.
Yes.
Actually, what you're pointing out there is part of what the narrative remove, like, because they have to talk through the translator, like, she doesn't get that idea right away that there's only one. And then she has to reflect on it later. And there's other things like the villagers refer to the diamonds. Like, she asks about the immortals and they talk about the diamonds and she assumes it's a translation problem, but it's actually because they're the same thing. And that helps the kind of narrative excavation, that kind of like getting down and figuring things out. Like, if you told this story from the point of view of villager, everything would be laid out in the first paragraph. You wouldn't get that impact.
Right.
We have to have the point of view from somebody who has to discover it.
I'm wondering now if we had this exact conversation with the other Le Guin story.
We had this a similar conversation, I think, with H.G. Wells's The Country of the Blind, because that was set up in a similar way.
Well, I remember having a conversation, though, about maybe not just the structure, but the idea that there's a little bit of loss in translation, but it forces the narrator, whoever is telling us the story, where you're kind of like circling a similar point. But I remember talking on the podcast at some point about how an inexpert writer might circle the point where it becomes repetitive and they're not saying anything new. But with a writer like Le Guin, the fact that we're having to have confusing conversations more than once about what the diamonds are and that we don't have an answer is not repetitive, even though it might be frustrating. It's actually getting closer and closer to the core root of
it. We did talk about that in Omelas. We talked about how she kind of like revisits the idea in a new way. Like, let's look at it this way. Now let's look at it this way. And we keep coming back to it, but we're looking at it with fresh perspective. I don't know if we put it that way, but that was the gist of it, I think.
Well, in my head, it's the same. And I remember having this conversation where it's like, if you put like a pencil on a piece of paper and then tie a string to the other one and you go tighter and tighter, like the line that you would draw covers new paper each time.
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like when you're reading this stuff. It's like, didn't we just talk about this? Wasn't it similarly confusing? And it's only like when you really look back that you realize like, no, actually she's sharing something new each time. And each time it's revisited, it becomes clearer and clearer and like tighter and closer on the point. And this, I think, is only accomplished with like very careful editing, like lots of editing.
Yeah. You edit it in order to hone how you're looking at the thing in each pass. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That part feels familiar too, now that we talk about the idea, even that, like you said, she has to revisit this conversation in her head after it happens, because in the moment she's chalking it up to the translation or whatever. She's busy having the conversation, so she's going to think about it later, obviously. And then it makes sense that a writer like Le Guin maybe is, you know, like personally interested in the types of stories that have kind of a lingering question, right? That maybe don't draw definitive conclusions, but make you get closer and closer to the point.
What is one thing about stories, like some of the best stories are not stories that every page introduce something new to it, right? Like, and then he does this and then he does something else and it's like moves on to another thing. And it's like, you don't know what's going to happen next. And it feels exciting because it's unknown. But a kind of a better way to do it is to not go on to something new, but return to what you already did, but in a new way.
Yeah,
so you dig deeper and deeper and deeper into that. That is a way to really dig down, especially if you're trying to write into a theme, like an idea, is to have multiple characters or multiple perspectives or multiple approaches, just some way to multiply the number of ways in which you explore the theme or the idea that the story is like quote unquote about.
Yeah.
And you make them progressive, and that's why it feels like you're circling something, but you're getting closer every time.
In this story, I think the facet that does that is like just the passage of time, right? She's not doing it through different like points of view. And it is really quick. It's almost like at the beginning, she's got a concept of this. She books the flight. She goes on the trip. She's finishing the trip. And then right after the trip, she's thinking about it. But you can also do it in a story probably over the course of a character's entire life, you know, or like several years. And then it becomes like richer and richer.
Well, each one of these is like a conversation. She's talking to the travel agent and the travel agent introduces the first pass. Then she's reading the books about it and like the quoted sections and her summaries of the books are the second pass. And then she's like on her way to the island. She talks to like the boat pilot.
Yeah.
And then she talks to villagers. It's like every time it's a new quote unquote perspective in that it's a conversation with some new person, even though it's always her perspective, but she's getting information from that new person's perspective, which offers a different kind of point of view on the central question, which is what's up with these immortals?
Yeah. That'd be a good title.
What's up with these immortals?
Yeah. I like this idea of, well, my takeaway was just going to mostly be focused on the fact that immortality is a theme or, you know, an idea that I think a lot of fiction visits. nonprofits and nonfiction and movies. I mean, this is not something we're unfamiliar with, but I thought that this came up with a good sort of answer to why you shouldn't want to be immortal, you know? Like I said, I think a lot of the stuff that I've looked at least, it doesn't really talk about the quality of life so much as like what's lost in a human experience if you become immortal. And here it's like, it's the exact opposite. You know, you cease to be human, it feels like. You know, not just that like you lose some quality that would make your life richer. I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about things like Lord of the Rings and Twilight, you know, where it's like, these are really like characters that stay young and hot forever. And it's always centered around, well, but I'm madly in love and I'll lose the love of my life if they're not immortal. And here it's like, oh yeah, we're not talking about long lost loves. We're talking about being blind and deaf.
I can't believe you put it Lord of the Rings and Twilight in the same sentence there.
I'm sorry. Twilight's shitty. I know.
I never read it and I don't know.
You don't need to. But yeah, my takeaway was very much going to be about the idea that this is a common theme, but maybe you can answer it in a way that you at least haven't seen answered, you know? This is not a unique story idea.
Oh, and there's many of them out there. You don't have to, read this one. You can read something else and say, I have a different perspective on that.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of like a different sort of like theme or whatever, like, you know, like a central question, like that lots of stories ask like this and usually have to answer through a sci-fi or fantasy lens. But anyway, immortality being one of them, if you're young forever, whatever, all these things that are very common. My takeaway is very much like you can revisit a question that you were familiar with and come up with your own takeaway, your own interpretation, your own response to it, and have what is a piece that I'll remember as standing out from the others. You know, like this ground can't be covered enough.
My takeaway is just this idea of perspective, like taking different points of view on the central theme, and that this story only makes that possible because of the point of view it takes. It's like an exploration point of view, an explorer's point of view, you know, like the Country of the Blind, that story could only make sense by having a visitor go to the Country of the Blind, because that visitor brought the dictum in the Country of the Blind, a man with one eye is king, as a starting place. But the blind people aren't going to have that idea.
Right.
And then he gets to discover that it's garbage. Whereas she knows nothing about these immortals and even has this idea like, oh, immortality sounds kind of neat. Everyone
right.
who's aware of it says, no, this is the saddest thing you've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
We don't even want to talk about it. But she has to be the one to dig into it. And then beyond that, merely the narrative point of view is each new revelation in the story is brought about by a different perspective on the central idea, like we talked about, who she's talking to at the time,
right.
the travel agent, etc. So the way that you can play with point of view to make this story move forward like that, it's really cool. I mean, our kind of shorthand for point of view is so lacking. Like you just say, oh, it's a first person story.
Yeah.
But when we dig into it, we realize that point of view is so much more rich. There's so many more things that point of view are doing in this story.
Yeah, right. I think if I was going to do a story like this, it'd be easier for me to think about introducing the points of view that make her change her mind about this central question just by the passage of time. Like I could see this being very much something where you could answer the question about any big life question and just write a story about a character revisiting it 3 or 4 times throughout their life and just how it would change. It seems like a really easy way to kind of structure a story too. Like I could see the first sentence being like, when I was 13, I thought blank, you know?
Oh yeah. The Richard Powers story we did a long time ago about the lifetime spent with that book.
Oh yeah.
I don't remember that story very well, but I feel like it was structured that way.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
It was just how the main character's relationship with the book changed over their lifetime and like the different moments of that. So there's so many different ways you can approach that idea.
Right.
Before we end, I want to mention one more thing just about the language of this.
Okay.
I found myself like really amused by this line where she says, news anchors would pontificate it and the Pope would do some pontificating too. It reminded me that pontificate comes from pontiff. It's just like, mm-hmm. I was like, you don't think about those things, but then you get hit by a line like that. It's like, this is why we love writers, because they just, mm-hmm. the language. But then the other moment of language that I thought, especially because of our previous couple of episodes, we're talking about style, and especially the Faulkner one with like long run-on, so-called run-on sentences. The like fourth paragraph from the end is, maybe it's two sentences. There's one, it's, I turned around and walked back across the marshy plains to the town where I waited 4 more days until the sister ship came by from the west, and the nice young man took me out in the boat, and I left the island of the immortals, and soon after that I left the Indian plain. It's a run-on sentence, but it's a run-on sentence for for a reason. Like in that moment, she's trying to get away as fast as she can. She's just wanting like, let's sprint away from this village as fast as we can. And we're going to get out of here in one sentence, even though it takes more than what a single sentence can encompass. So we're going to jam it all into a single sentence. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing you can do with style, even momentary style, where the rest of the, there might be a run on, but for the most part, the rest of the story is no run on sentences until we get to that one. And it's there for a reason. And it's evocative because of that structure.
That's a really good way to think about how you might introduce style into your own piece, right? If you're trying to play with your own style or create your own voice. I know we talked when we did the Faulkner story about how it's sort of an exhausting style to have to mimic, right? Unless that was your way of speech. I mean, it would be a labor for you to write that way. But like you said, you can insert style for a singular point, and really almost by dropping it in, it sets it off as being a little more important. Like it highlights it, you know?
But that's one of the points I made in that, or one of the things I tried to say in that, was that style should change from beginning to end of the story, but it can shift as the mood that you're trying to portray or trying to get at shifts. And in this sentence, this single sentence, there's a slightly different mood than the other sentences, right? It's more frantic than what follows and what precedes it. There's building up to that franticness. Then when we get to that franticness, we get this really long run on sentence, which encompasses it, kind of like puts it into the reader's head kind of subliminally. And then after we leave it, then there's some reflection. That's when she realizes the thing about that single fly, right? There's only one.
As you were saying this, this is what I'm thinking too, but I probably didn't articulate it like properly either. It's the idea that, like you said, like this style in this particular place, like serves a very specific purpose. And maybe sometimes when we read stories like Faulkner's or Hemingway, right? Like we think that we have to have a style that's pervasive, like throughout a piece to what, I don't know, be remembered for that. But maybe it's easier these days for us to realize that they can be used and they can change. And it's not something you have to adopt permanently to like be your writerly persona, right? I'm long-winded. I write run-on sentences, or I write these short clip sentences like Hemingway. No, like you can be known as the person that uses the correct style when it's called for.
Yeah, that's right. To go back to my original point several episodes ago, I don't think authors should have styles or voices. I think stories should have voices, and those voices can change.
Right, that makes sense. Well, thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/Naples Writers Workshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.